Two Dimension. I'm Don Moore, and with me is my friend Al Val.
Hey there.
I'm just curious, Al, is that short for Aloysius?
No, it's just Al Val. My parents wanted to give me the smallest name ever, so...
Yeah, it sounded like a showbiz name.
Yeah, it's like Stan Lee.
Yeah, Stan Lee, Al Val.
Or Jim Lee, or whatever, but yeah, no.
Actually, you could have been one of the guys in the Superman cast. Lois Lane, Lex Luthor, Al Val.
Yeah, there you go. Well, you know, yeah. I would have had a Al Val, maybe, or something. I don't know. But
you know,
anyway.
That guy that just ran for president, Mitt Romney, I always thought that's the perfect comic book. He looked like a comic book superhero, you know? I mean, honestly, he had the look.
Yeah.
And even when he talked to me, he seemed to have a superhero voice. And the name Mitt Romney, he could hang with Steve Rogers, you know?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I never thought about that. He's got one of those, like, you know, like nicknames or whatever that could work or whatever. But, oh, well. But, yeah, it's Albert Val.
Oh, no Aloysius. That would
no
be
Aloysius.
Kind of cool.
No, there was no Irish people in my family that I know. If that's an Irish name, I'm not even sure. But anyway. So how the hell are you, Don?
I'm doing good. Once again, it's just Al and myself. The younger side of Two Dimension couldn't
get...
Yeah,
right. The new guys.
The new guys.
We just started reading comics 10 years ago.
But, No, yeah, everything's been good. It's busy, but good at this, all at the same time.
And we have been reading comics.
Yeah. Let's just start off on what we've been reading.
Well, you know, actually, you mentioned Superman, and I just saw something on, I think it was on Yahoo, that they're changing his costume again for the next movie. He's not going to have any, like, red underwear anymore. They got rid of that. So he's got like a Batman-ish looking suit going on, and it looks all grim and gritty, you know, like everything does these days. So not looking forward to it.
You know, as a kid, I liked swimming. It was always cool to wear swimming trunks. And that old Filmation Superman cartoon, I realized Superman had red swim trunks on his outfit.
Yeah, sure.
And the long boots. And I thought, man, that's cool. I always liked it. I always thought that was neat. And most of the time, whenever you try to make up your own superhero, they wore trunks.
Sure.
And most of the superheroes had trunks. Superman had them. Batman still has them. You know. Aquaman had black ones. Basically, everybody, with the exception of the Flash, had trunks. And Jack Kirby's characters had trunks, but they were always colored the same as the pants. It was
circus Captain America and all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, now, that's
Daredevil
all.
Daredevil had trunks, too, now that you think about
it. Yeah, it still does. It's the same color. The Fantastic Four, their jumpsuits, they had trunks.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But it was sometime in the mid-2000s, I just started hearing guys bag on the fact Superman's a cat that wears his underwear on the outside. I'm thinking, it's not just Superman. Batman wears them, too.
Hell yeah.
Know? And so
Metamorpho.
Yeah, Metamorph.
They all do.
But if you ever look at circus acrobats, you know, their costumes, they're always,
yes.
There's a bunch of different kinds of costumes, but trunks are a main part. But all of a sudden, it was this big crusade about Superman in the red underwear, and I think they did away. Didn't Jim Lee design a Superman costume without the trunks?
Yeah, I think he did. Now that you mention it, I'm not 100% sure, but I think he did.
And that Legion of Superheroes cartoon they had, you know, Superman, which was actually Superboy, he didn't have trunks in that, which it was a neat-looking uniform.
Yeah,
but
uh-huh.
Yeah, I don't see the issue of it, and they can continue to design him as much as they want. I really don't care, you know.
Yeah, I was just talking to somebody, a friend of mine before on the phone, and we were talking about, in our cases, how, like, they're making the characters unrecognizable to us. You know, and we were the generation, I think anyway, that kind of elevated them to what they are now, because the generation before us just was disposable.
Yeah.
You know, we're the ones who, you know, turned Batman into a big movie. I mean, yeah, you had the Superman TV show and all that, but, you know, when we were around, that's when comics really started hitting big. So they're kind of like, you know, saying, nah, screw you. We're changing it now for these new people who don't know any better. And I don't know. I propose the idea that maybe the big two should actually create a line of books of comics that are just the original characters in in the original, in similar situations, and then they can have that whole universe, and then the rest of the books can be the ultimate or whatever, you know, newfangled thing that you want to do for the new kids or whatever, you know. Not that it necessarily, I don't know if it necessarily would work, but I would rather go and back and read, I would go rather go back and read new stories about the way I like the books than having them changed every year just because they can.
Well, I don't know. I think a lot of it's just trying to keep them contemporary, keep them in the times that they're at. You know, we always mention Captain Marvel, that when you read those stories, it seems to me like they need to be in the 40s and the 50s.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, and of course, some characters, they went on, Superman and Batman, but I don't know, a lot of times I just think, I think Darwin Cook, whenever he draws certain characters like the New Frontier, he draws it at the time that they were, you know. I've always looked at the Fantastic Four as something from the 60s, and even though I've liked stories since, you know, but I've always seen them as the 60s and 70s type.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I don't know, it's just the whole thing is trying to keep the characters in today and keep them, you know, to where the kids want to read them.
and we're supposed to believe that the kids are actually reading them. That's a laugh, okay? It's not kids. It's adults and younger adults that have picked them up. Yeah. I don't think kids are reading comics anymore. I never see any at the comic shops.
No, like I said, that's always a joke. Dharma Cook did that comic strip we posted on the blog about comic stores, and it finishes in the 2000s. And it's, what's that? Oh, it's someplace. My dad goes there sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Right. Yeah. Now it's going to be like downloading and Amazon and, you know, whatever.
So. You know, they do that everywhere. I was in the 80s. I guess this is like 86. There was a rock station in San Diego, and they were doing an interview with Malcolm McLaurin, you know, the Sex Pistols manager.
Yeah.
And, he was telling his whole history and the history of the Sex Pistols and all that, and then he started explaining about the music industry came up with this style called New Wave, and he was explaining about the reason they did that was you could put Mick Jagger next to Simon Le Bon, you know, and not make him look like a dinosaur. You know, Mick Jagger's from the Rolling Stones, if you didn't know, which was from the 60s, and Simon Le Bon was the lead singer of Duran Duran from the 80s. Much different style, but New Wave was kind of a cross between the old and the punk rock type stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the thing, you kind of repackage everything to where it seems contemporary and this and that. Everybody does that.
Yeah, it's repackaging and, you know, repackaging and... Yeah, you get to the point where enough of the repackaging. Give me something new. Give me something different. Or just go back to basics. A lot of times, and I can tell you this with music. You know, remember in the 60s, it started out with, like, you know, the rock and rollers, and then they started getting more and more into things, and it became like psychedelic. And when it got to the point where it was just way too psychedelic and way too out there, everybody just went back to the roots.
Yeah.
Comics ain't doing that, man.
No.
They need to go back to their roots and just realize that it's time to start over again. And I'm not talking about, you know, issue zero of the Marvel Universe. Just go back to the original things and build from there. I mean, that's just the way I feel. I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, but if you look at, you know, comics outside the mainstream publishers, I sometimes think they do that. They're, you know.
So the outside, I'm talking about the big two or the big three or whatever. The outsiders do, and some of the outsiders are doing very well. They're making money. So,
oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah, I'm just talking about the guys that we grew up with, the superheroes, the, you know, the guys in long underwear or whatever. The ones that all they do is make movies about them, like, and they change everything, and they get, you know, silly people to play them. Anyway, so we're here to talk about comics. So what comics are we going to talk about, Don? I see a couple there.
Well, one thing I wanted to bring up, this is an older comic I just found. DC had a series called Solo, which is basically they choose one artist, Mark
Chiarello.
Chiarello, yeah, he was the one that put it together. But each issue is by, you know, one of these whoever artists they chose, and he could do anything he wanted. And as long as, I guess, a few stories you used a DC character in it. And I've gotten some of the old ones. I really like Darwin Cook's. That was always my favorite since Sergio Arguez did one. I just picked this one up. It's Howard Chaykin. And I've always loved Howard Chaykin. I liked him when he started with DC with Iron Wolf and Sword and Sorcery. My favorite work he's ever done was when he started doing American Flag in the 80s. And some of the DC work he did, like The Shadow, you know, Blackhawks, he always hits on all cylinders. But this solo he did, I was kind of shocked. Like I said, I've always liked him. He was one of those creators that as soon as I saw what he did, I'd pick it up and, you know, get it. But this one, I don't know, it's several stories, and they're all just people. One's about a black jazz musician in Paris when the Nazis take over. And another one's about a white supremacist family. And then I guess the wife is trying to, as a surprise, finding out he was adopted, finding out his ancestry. It's all these stories like that. And I also keep thinking of what you're talking about, romance comics. You know, you liked it because you see, or that Beatles comics George Perez did. You get to see these guys drawing regular people and regular stories. And this entire issue, that's what I saw in there. I've never really seen Howard Chaykin do that type of work before. He's always done the fantasy figures, as I said, or American Flag was, you know, I guess kind of regular people in a futuristic world, but I'd like to see more work like this.
I'm kind of having mixed feelings about Chaykin. I liked his earlier work a lot better than I do now. And I'm just talking about artistically or whatever. I've picked up a few things that he's been in, like Dark Horse Presents and a few things, and his art's kind of mutated into something that I don't particularly care for now. The stories might be good. I'm just talking about art-wise or whatever. I don't like his style anymore.
Oh, really?
You know? Yeah. Ever since American Flag, which was like his big book, he's kind of like he's done something. Like maybe it's the lettering or maybe the way he designs it. It just kind of leaves me a little bit cold. I mean, some of those stories look interesting because there's a horror story and all different types or whatever. But I never liked his revamping of the Blackhawks and I don't know. I think he's trying too hard to be a cutting edge guy. I don't know. It's just not.
Saying is exactly, I feel that way in an opposite kind of way. I liked Howard Chaykin in the past, and he always kind of played around with things, and to me, he always kind of had a bit of a sketchiness to him.
Yeah, sure. Now, in the early days, more so.
Exactly. I didn't like his Star Wars comic. That one upset me.
Sketchy.
Yeah, and sometimes I always hear jokes. I was at a comic store when I was in high school, and somebody's talking about him. Some artists do really good work, and then sometimes they just kind of knock it out. And then the guy that ran the store said, yeah, you have to watch out for Chaykin especially. Well, I've seen some. One was a Micronauts issue that Howard Chaykin drew.
I think somebody like Vince Coletta?
Yeah, I was going to say Vince Coletta inked it. And,
yeah, okay, we'll give him a pass on.
Yeah, so that's, you know, I'm not sure what it looked like before he got a hold of it. But
yeah.
I always liked Howard Chaykin, but it was when he started doing those painted graphic novels, Stars, My Destiny,
and the Cody
Starbuck stuff. When I say this, I don't mean to make myself look bad. I'd see those, and I loved how they looked.
The look of them was beautiful. The design's beautiful.
Yeah, the way he was drawing the characters, and they all had boots with kind of high heels. They all had high collars like Elvis liked.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And how he was putting them. Arranging the figures on the page, I've never seen it like that, and it was very graphic, but I don't know, maybe I was too young at the time, but I just found the stories just kind of boring in how they were told. When he started doing American Flag, that stuff just blew my mind. I loved how he drew it. I loved the graphicness of it, but you're right, he started getting a lot more geometric shapes into everything, more,
It almost looks like he designs the page. And like the figures, I mean, a lot of people do that. You know, you design the page, and then the figures become kind of like geometrical shapes within the page. I think that worked for Alex Toth, but I don't know if it's. I mean, and I think there was a period in Chaykin's career which There was a couple of books. There was one called Monarch, Star Slayer, or whatever, when he was doing his Tothy things. And that might have been during a sketchy period, but I think it worked better that way because it looked more organic within a geometrical, you know, field. But this thing, these look very geometrical, and the figures look very tight and geometrical. So
yeah,
it kind of leaves me a little cold, a little bit.
Well, see, I've liked it. The American flag work, to me, that's some of the best comics ever. I liked the stories. I liked how he put them together. And I liked what he was saying. And again, it was kind of shocking. I was reading these when I was in the Navy on a ship. And he had all these hammer and sickle earrings and stuff all the women wore.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, I hope they don't nail me for this. Because, you know.
Neo-Nazi or something.
You know, that kind of stuff. One time I was in downtown San Diego, and there was a used magazine store, and they had all these issues of Pravda. And I thought, I wonder what those are like. And I thought, I can't bring it on the ship. Next thing you know, they have me in the brig. But
So you made it.
Yeah, well, I never. But, you know, Howard Chaykin, he liked the strong images. It's not that he was into the communism, but...
No doubt, yeah.
But I did like it, and I did like the Black Hawk miniseries. His Shadow miniseries, I thought, was fantastic, and it seemed like his artwork in Knowles, he wasn't putting as much as he was in American Flag, but it's how he was putting the story together and how he's telling it. It was something. So I've always liked Howard Chaykin. Some of his later work, I don't know, it seemed like he just got even further into it, and it didn't seem like he's putting in as much effort. As I saw. But I did like some. He did a Marvel thing, Avengers 1953, 59, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I bought those and liked them. I thought they were kind of over-colored, but that wasn't him. But this right here, I just love it. I'd like to see more of it. And
no, that's a series. Darwin Cook did one. Corbin did one. Jordy Bernay did one. There's a bunch of these solos.
I've got a few. Somebody sent me a Paul Pope one, and there was another guy I've never heard of that, you know, I've never seen the Darwin Cook one, but it was a neat series. Sergio Ganez did one that was quite nice.
It's funny because when I was a kid in high school, I met this one kid, Ernie, who was the guy who took me to my first comic convention, and we always used to have running, not arguments, but we used to talk about artists, and his favorite artist was Howard Chaykin. Yeah. And at the time, mine was Gray Morrow, and I remember writing him in his yearbook. You know, Chaykin's pretty good, but Gray Morrow is much better. And he did the opposite on mine or whatever just to get back at me. But we always had that running, they're completely different artists.
Well, but, you know, it's like you and I are talking. I agree with everything you're saying, but to you, what he started turning into, you didn't enjoy. Whereas what he started turning into,
you enjoy.
To me, that was... I think he's one of the greatest. I met him in '82, and he's extremely interesting. I really enjoy reading about
him. He's one of those artists that I think I like better originally than I did. Well, there's a lot of artists a lot of times that you like originally better than, you know, they do. But I think I like the sketchy artwork better for whatever reason. I don't know. Maybe I like sketchy artwork better than, you know, tight artwork or whatever. But that's definitely a cool book. It's worth walking. Do you get that at Wilson's?
No, I got that on mycomicshop.com.
Oh, one of our new favorite places to go to find oddball books that we can't find anywhere else. No,
yeah,
at a good price.
That's the blast.
Yeah. So on the other side, you've got another artist there.
Well, I was shocked you picked this up for me. It was Joe Kuber Presents from DC Comics.
Oh, that's a cool book. Yeah.
Yeah, that's slick.
He's the complete opposite. He's very loose.
Yeah, he's loose. I guess the thing that always got me was when I always see Joe Kubert, and I still see him this way, is really sketchy. You know, it's like he draws with ink and he renders with ink, and it's light and fluid and sketchy and always was, and kind of sad. And I always remember as a Hawkman artist and also doing all those DC War comics and Tarzan. But the thing that I've grown to really, well, I've always loved about him, but I just started noticing in the past 10 years was how he laid his pages out in his stories. And it's kind of funny, as loose and fluid and sketchy as he is, he has really tight layouts, you know, and tight storytelling. So he was just, But the Joe Kubert's Presents, this one I thought was a little confusing. He's basically talking about he loved the anthologies, and so he put one together, and the first one is a Hawkman story he did, which I haven't seen him do that in a billion years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
And it was pretty good. Reading it, though, I didn't know that Hawkman and Hawkgirl could talk to animals.
Was I didn't that? Know that either.
Well, they can in this story.
I thought it was only Dr. Doolittle. But,
well, like Aquaman can, you know, command
the sea
all
creatures,
the...
Yeah. It's like a Tarzan kind of commands... You know, the,
yeah, but
he does,
these,
he does the yell.
They go to Africa and they basically tell the elephants and all that, and they all do their just like Aquaman did, which is kind of cool. But then there was an Angel and Ape story by
Brian Bruniac.
Yeah, that one kind of confused me. What's this doing in here? But
I think he's one of his students.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, he's a good artist. He's been around for a while.
I read the story. It was kind of fun.
The last one's good.
Yeah, well, like I said, Joseph Kubert's got another. Looks like he's done a pencil. What is it called? Spit. Yeah, I was right, Spit.
Yeah.
And then your man, Sam Glansman, did a really nice story.
Yeah, those are really nice because he was there. He was on the ship.
Yeah.
So he's got first-hand experience. That's one of those guys that I like a hell of a lot more now than I did when I was a kid.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of him as a kid. Like I said, I always talk about that novel, the Sailor Story.
That one. That's about the USS Stevens or whatever he was on.
Which is what he talked about here, which sank.
I didn't know that.
I think the Stevens is the one that sank. On the ship in World War II, and the ship sank. And they were out in the water watching the ship go down. How horrifying, you know, and another ship picked him up. They survived, but... You know, and the story, in the Sailor Story, he was writing about that, and he said that, I can't tell you what it's like, but, you know, just reading that page, it really ripped me out, and the Navy today, I just can't imagine that ever happening, you know, from the Navy I was in. I mean, it could happen, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, that was some life, you know.
Yeah, I think there's a second issue out already, which I haven't gotten yet, and it continues with the USS Stevens stuff or whatever. And I don't know about the Kubert, if it's still Hawkman or not, but yeah, that's going to be the last thing he probably ever did. So those are going to be like a great, you know, final farewell.
It is fun. You know, anthologies when I was a kid, I always kind of enjoyed them, but,
I still do.
Well, I've gotten to where I didn't like them. And I guess it's kind of like we talked about Taboo. You said they were hit or miss, and I've always enjoyed, anthologies, as I saw, I guess as long as the people are putting as much effort in everything as normal. Half the time it seems like some anthologies, they just take whatever they can get, or they take back matter that, you know, wasn't good enough to be published before. But this one, it's pretty good. Even though I thought the Angel and the Ape was kind of strange, I still enjoyed it, and I didn't mind it being in there.
Angel and the Ape, they were all the old ones, I think, where Wally Wood did some of them, and Bob Oxner did some. Yeah, those were nice.
Well, I knew Oxner did them.
I think Wally did a few of them. Those were real nice, man. Yeah, oh, man, those were real nice.
Those were fun stories. I read some of them, and I always liked it. And
DC had actually some of the most fun comics back then. You know, Marvel was getting real serious, you know, into the... superheroes or whatever. DC was kind of like a lot more lighthearted in a lot of ways.
Well, as a kid, that's why I liked them. When I was later years in high school and college especially, I liked the Marvel stuff, you know.
Because yeah.
I remember Walt Simonson was saying that he was in college when Jack Kirby, you know, was doing Thor and the Fantastic Four and all that. So I think they were putting out eight books or 11 books. He was buying them all. But that's what he's talking about. It kind of brought him in. I noticed a lot of those guys were in college age when Marvel came out, and they started following this stuff. But yeah, the DC, there was a big variety, and it was just fun.
Yeah, especially in the 60s, you know, because you had the kind of like the old, you know, the Batmans and the Supermans were kind of like the old standards, but they started making fun of the Marvels with the Inferior Five and all that stuff. And I bought one a few months ago. I was kind of surprised at how blatant they were. They were making fun of the Hulk and the Thing and all that. And I guess I'm like, how did they get away with that? I go, oh, just they're being satirical.
But Marvel did that too. They had that comic
not Brand Eck.
Well, yeah, but when I was, what was it?
Crazy was later. It was in the 70s.
Well, 1973, there was a comic book that said, Watch out, world. Marvel's gone mad. And then across it said, Crazy. and it had Superman on the cover with the Fantastic Four fighting him. But Superman had a dollar sign on his chest instead of the S. And I think Marie Severin drew it.
Yep.
And I loved it. It was like the, I don't know, second, third issue. I never saw the other ones. But all my friends, they just could not wait to read it. But the front story was about Superman. Told his whole story, how he came down, and how he's completely mass merchandised and all that. And the very end of the story, the last page was all Marvel. You know, Captain America had roller skates. The whole Marvel, you know, line was busted on the page, and Superman was standing aside crying, you know. And it said, "Look out, world, it's the Marvel Age of comics." The second story in that issue was about the Fantastic Four. And again, it was all over the top and crazy and told their whole history. But, you know, all in the Superman story, everything that these guys were saying, the words were always starting with DC, you know. Direct communication, you know, stuff like that all the time. So, yeah, both sides. There was a Legion of Superheroes story where Chameleon Boy in the 60s or 50s. No, it had to be the 60s. Chameleon Boy turned into a spider and wrapped up all of the assailants in webs, you know. And then he looks in to the reader and says, "Any web-headed, you know, any web-headed slingshot guy or something like that thinks I've been stealing his thunder. I've been doing this long before you ever showed up." And, you know, I thought, well, he's talking to Spider-Man. So that stuff happened all the time, you know, back and forth.
Yeah, I mean, but the Inferior Five was in the 60s. Crazy was in the 70s. That was during their Marvel being naughty and try to put everybody out of business phase. Remember when they did all the Monster mags and all the other mags? It's like, hey, we're going to, like... squeeze a distributor into carrying all our books and not carrying yours. Yeah, that's not very nice.
Oh, they did that in the 80s, too.
They did, they've done that a lot.
They do that all the time, but, you know.
Yeah, that's kind of shitty.
But that distribution deal they had where they had to use DC's distributor, and they can only put out, like, what, 8 to 11 books?
Yeah, they got a dent to them first, but then they went back and Payback, you know. And Payback is a bitch,
I guess. You know, the comic book industry is a really cutthroat.
Oh man, it is. Well, on that book, you know, that one that you loaned me that one time, the way it started, yeah.
Yeah, A Minute Tomorrow.
It's very.
It started from the mafia and girly magazines.
Yeah, it started and, you know, whatever. Anyway, look, we're at the halfway point. You want to play some music or?
Yeah, Al and I were talking about Tampa Bay area bands, and I finally got some songs from a Dolores Telescope.
Oh,
and
cool.
You get to hear that now.
All right.
Yeah.
And that was Dolores Telescope, my favorite band of the Tampa Bay area.
Yeah, they're a good one. I never heard of them until recently, but they're very they're very great musicians. I mean, I saw there's a couple of clips on YouTube, them playing live, and they were tight, man.
Yeah, they were tight, and they were fun. They were kind of famous for Steve Robinson was telling me, you've heard of the Cheap Trick show? No. They opened for Cheap Trick when they came to Tampa. And it says, instead of doing the regular show, they just did all kind of bizarre experimental stuff, and everybody's booing them. And Steve said that was the thing they'd always do. Come to find out, it wasn't just one show. I guess they opened for Cheap Trick several times.
Yeah.
And they said, you know, a lot of people felt if they just go out and do the regular Dolores Telescope show, they just would have brought the house down and would have got signed. But they would, I never saw any of these shows. I'd hear about them. And one time they put out a tape called Milk the Glory. And on the tape they had all these kind of outtakes and inserts. And one was a show, I think it was in New York or New Jersey. And people are cussing at them and screaming. And, you know, Casey's up there reciting this kind of bizarre poetry kind of to himself. And it seemed like he's kind of agitating people. And they're all screaming, play a blinking song. And they put out a tape called Ting, which somebody lent to me, and it was just more of the same. I think, okay. But every time I saw them, they were the tightest band, and they were fun, and they always had. But I guess that's why they got that stuff, was just messing around sometimes.
Yeah, it'd be funny if somebody, let's say you were the opening a group, and you were the opening act for Cheap Trick. Well, it'd be funny if you wanted to really goof on people, is to get up there and then do Cheap Trick songs.
Yeah, they could have. They always.
They probably could have. Yeah.
But they were just terrific. It was a 3-piece band, and they seemed like they were 100 people, and they were just great fun. And they were great live. They were a great live band, and they always had a fun show.
What was it? When would they stop? Like in the early 90s?
Well, that's when I stopped because my kid was born.
Gotcha.
So the life changed. I think they probably stopped in the early 90s, probably 94 or so. But I think they've gotten back together recently for a show or something.
Yeah, like a 10 tribute show or something, an anniversary or something like that.
The Stevie Wilcox, we played, I think, last episode.
We did Annie O. Was it Annie O or Stevie
Wilcox? Yeah, it was Annie O. Ricky Wilcox.
Ricky Wilcox.
Yeah, we played him, I guess, before Annie O. So it must have been the other show.
All right.
So anyway, Ricky Wilcox and the Moonsnakes.
All right, so enough of music talk.
Okay, I've got, Al just showed me a book that I was not aware it came out, and by golly, I'm getting this. And Al?
It's called Frankenstein Alive, Alive. That's Alive, Alive. And it's brand new, Bernie Wrightson from IDW. And it's probably some of the nicest artwork you've seen in years from him. Very detailed, done in like gray washes. He did an Alive Alive, a first series last year. This is a continuation where, you know, they find Frankenstein again and they revive him. And now the professor is kind of like teaching him how to speak and all that stuff. But it's really, really beautiful rights and artwork. So.
And written by Steve Niles.
Steve Niles, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, this is, So he did a series before this?
Yeah, last year. There was another 3-parter.
Really?
It ended, and they just started back up again.
Have they collected it?
No, because it's really short, kind of. I mean, it's like a 3-issue series, but each issue may be like 15 pages or something, so I don't think.
And it's
not yet.
It's done on kind of a gray wash.
Gray wash, yeah.
That Bernie Wrightson likes, but I'll tell you, it's
It's heavily detailed, especially when you go into the laboratory. All the beakers and all that. There's like a floating alligator above or whatever. It's extremely detailed.
Yeah, and the laboratory has all the.
Yeah, well, that's Wrightson's big love. Yeah. You know, remember he did that Frankenstein book in the 70s,
which is fantastic.
Yeah, it took him years to do that, and I get a feeling he probably burned out his eyesight doing that because that was so detailed. Doing that thing.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised. I haven't seen Bernie Wrightson do any comic stories,
mainstream.
Or I guess, you know.
No.
The comic story, usually it's illustrations or they do his old work.
Reprints.
Yeah. And this, and sometimes when I would see, like we did that Spider-Man book for Marvel, it was the Hookie.
Yeah, it was okay.
Yeah, it wasn't up to his, you know, standards. What he usually does. I mean, it was good, but it just, you know, it wasn't Bernie Wrightson.
There was a Batman thing that came out a year ago, or maybe longer, and it was something that was sitting in DC's vault, and it was inked by Kevin Nolan. Forgot what it's called. I have it somewhere, and it's real nice. I never read it, but I bought it, like, cheap, you know, discounted at the Comics World, but that was the last thing, besides before this alive Frankenstein thing, that I'd seen in a while, so. But it's definitely, like, extremely nice. And Don's giving it a rave review. He's, like, reading it right now as we speak.
Well, and the cover, I can't stop looking away. He's got it's a black cover with a drawing of the monster in pink, you know, lighting.
Yeah, flesh tones or whatever.
And, you know, they got a gold oval around it, you know, with that gold leaf, which, honestly, I've never been a huge fan of, but in this one, it all works, and it looks like they did some type of a matte glaze on the monster.
Oh, okay. All right.
I can't stop looking at it. This monster has a bit more humanity than the one he did in that Frankenstein illustrated book.
Yeah. He decided not to give him nostrils, so he's got like the skeleton holds, but okay.
This is
whatever,
nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is
came out last week, I think.
I wasn't aware of it. I wasn't aware of the other series, and
It just came out last week. It's out at a comic shop near you.
Oh man, I'm so getting this. This is Bernie Wrightson was always one of my favorites. I always loved his stuff, and my daughter went to MegaCon this fall. She'd never been to a show before, and she made the mistake of asking me if I wanted to get anything signed. And Bernie Wrightson was there, and Jim Starlin was there. So I gave her, you know, that book, The Studio, and I gave her the Frankenstein Illustrated book. But I've never met these men, and I've always been very fortunate, except for one time, where the creators were really nice people. And you always hear horror stories about, you know, some people are nice. And I thought about it. I told my daughter, if you go up to these tables and these guys they seem rude or belligerent or anything, and it says, don't bother with it. And it says, just go away. You know, I'm sorry that I made you drag the books around. And she giggled about it. I says, and if you go up and ask them to sign and they're kind of rude to you, tell them my dad is no longer going to like you. But they were both terrific people. They were very helpful to her. They signed it, but she loved them. And according to my daughter, Bernie Wrightson has the coolest eyebrows she ever saw.
Yeah, he waxes them or something.
Are you serious?
He does something to make them like stick up, like, you know, like that.
I said, what's cool? They're just cool, so I don't know, but
Wait, this was at MegaCon?
No, what's the one in Atlanta?
Okay, DragonCon.
Oh, I said MegaCon, didn't I?
Yeah, I was going to say, did I miss?
Yeah.
Did I go to the... No, DragonCon she went to. That's a real big one. Yeah,
she went to DragonCon. She made a costume and went up there. And
oh, cool.
So, yeah, she brought those books, and Jim Starlin was really nice as well. She asked him to sign. He goes, where do you want me to sign? He goes, I don't know. And he said, well, normally people on this kind of book. I had the graphic novel, that Death of Captain Marvel. And
yeah.
He says, well, normally they have me, you know, sign it here. Okay. Ooh, first edition. Well, it's my dad's. But I was really wanting to get him to sign the Warlock comics I had. Those are my favorites by him.
Yeah, they sure are.
And I could not find them before she left, so I just, you know, I mean, everything I've got by him I love, but...
Yeah, I saw Wrightson once. He was a nice guy. It was at I'm going back like 15, 16, 17 years. It was when I was in South Florida. He was at a comic shop, and he was, doing autographs. I don't know if he was charging it. I guess he was, but my friend wanted a lot of stuff autographed.
Yeah.
So he got like a bunch of us to go with him. So if he would, you know, so it looked like he was autographing them for different people, but it wasn't. It was just for him. But Wrightson was real nice. I asked him about Jeff Jones.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, he's doing some great work. His card set's coming out and all that. And he did have the waxed eyebrows.
They
like stick up, like it's like a, I don't know what you call it, Wolverine. He does like whatever, you know.
You know, we had a vice president where at the company Al and I in Dallas work at, and he was he was a commander of special forces in Vietnam, which I honestly have trouble believing, but it was true.
We did?
Yeah.
That guy who's just retiring?
No, not him.
Oh, okay.
It was one before. But,
okay, all right.
He wasn't what he seemed. He was actually extremely interesting, but his eyebrows were like that. He kind of combed them up, and Jack Kirby was kind of that way, you know. And I kept thinking, why don't you just get a pair of scissors and clip them, you know? I mean, and then it started happening to me, and I realized, oh, okay, when you get to a certain age, it just keeps growing.
Like, yeah, I don't know. But Wrightson figured out a way to, you know, work it to his advantage, I guess.
Yeah, well, again, according to my daughter, they're the coolest she's ever seen, so, you know.
Yeah, he was kind of like, well, we'll talk about some of his and his pals later on, but they were like the, in the early 70s, they were like the new guys. You know, we were used to like, you know, starting in the late 60s or mid 60s, you know, the old guys were kind of like hitting their peaks or, you know, going downhill or whatever you want to do. But it seemed like it was a closed shop for a while. And then Steranko got in and then Neil Adams got in. But Wrightson, Jones, Kaluta, Smith, and Rich Buckler, Chaykin, a few others, Simonson, they were the new guys that, you know, put in, you know, started the new blood. So, but yeah, Wrightson was like, you know, the swamp thing. So it was the best thing, you know, that he might have ever done. I mean, well, I like the creepy stuff actually better, but the swamp thing stuff was like totally amazing, you know, with the one, especially the one where he meets Batman. That was like awesome, that book.
Yeah, that was a great, well, you know, Bernie Wrightson and Michael Kaluta, I love the comic book work, and I always look at them as a comic book theme, but I've always seen those guys as more like illustrators that did comics than comic book. You know, Neil Adams, I'll always see as a comic book guy, even though he's advertising and quite successful. Walt Simonson, I've always seen him as a cartoonist.
See, I'm the opposite, because I remember them coming in as cartoonists, but they developed into illustrators. Because if you look at, well, what the hell, we'll just go into this book here right now, because I got these two right here. That we got from mycomicshop.com. It's a couple of issues of Flash Gordon from the 60s, issue 13 and 18. Well, 13's got like a 10-page Jeff Jones story. And Jeff Jones was an illustrator, more so than the comic book artist. Because he was, even if you look at the story, his storytelling is okay. It's not great, it's okay, it's very design-oriented. He was doing already paintings. And he was doing a lot of illustrations at the time. And this is very early, but it's actually kind of nice. And the Pat Boyette stuff is real nice, too. He was another guy that's kind of like not rated highly because, you know, I don't want to put him down, but some of his people didn't. They were kind of ugly sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
But he drew well, and the layouts were real nice, and the design quality was real nice. But this has got like an early Jeff Jones, and it's pretty good for its time. But this one here is kind of weird, this 18. It's got, I think it's the first Kaluta story in it, but it's very strange because this is a Flash Gordon book, and the Kaluta story is a 4-pagers about great battles of yesterday. It's a battle about the Shah of Iran back in whatever century fighting against some other guy. But the thing about it is, to me, it's like Wrightson and Kaluta and even Barry Smith really started out doing sequential art. But as their work became more and more, you know, developed, then they started to really look at the other artists, and they became, you know, more like illustrators. I mean, you could say that Frazetta was kind of like the same way, too. It was more of an illustrator than a comic book artist. So you can even say the same thing about Al Williamson, but Williamson was more of a, you know, sequential guy, too.
Like Barry Smith, I've always seen him as a comic book artist that later started doing more fine art illustration type stuff.
Yeah, like the four of them did. They decided they were going to... You know why they did it, too, is because I think it has something to do with money because of the comic book thing. You know, like, they got out of the business around the same time that they started importing all the artists from overseas or whatever, because I think they were starting... Neil Adams and them wanted to unionize, and the comic book people, the comic book company said, no way. If you guys start to do this, we're just going to get a bunch of people, and we're going to, you know. So I think through necessity, they kind of became more like illustrators.
Well, the four of them, they had the studio, which was Bernie Wrightson, Michael Kaluta, Jeff Jones, and Barry Smith. They had a studio together. And
that's a great book, too.
Oh, yeah, it's a fantastic book. But one of them had some type of thing where you could snap snap a photo of the artwork, you know, like copy, and it was in four color, and they could print it out.
Right.
And so they started selling them through mail order and selling them at shows and stuff. And those guys started, that's where the whole cottage industry business came
about. Do it yourself, no middleman. We're selling it, pure profit. That's what they do now. That's what they do now with music. A lot of these bands now, they don't have a record company. They sell it on their own. They make more money that way.
Well, that's why they started doing more illustration stuff. And that's where that book, The Studio, came out.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, and that, yeah, I think it was to do with the strikes and the Filipino artists coming in and stuff.
Filipinos anymore, and the Spanish artists too. They wanted they wanted benefits. They wanted more money. And DC and Marvel said, "No, we'll find other people to replace you." Because I think they would have continued. I mean, Wrightson still did sequential art. Kaluta always did a sequential art. I think Jones didn't anymore. He did the Idle book, which is only a one pager.
Yeah, but those were awesome.
Those were awesome. Oh, I've got it right there. The oversized one right there. Some of my favorite work ever.
Yeah, it's my favorite Jeff Jones work.
It's like his sense of design. Oh, sorry about that.
That's all right. Oh, I've got the same book, but mine's
Yeah, that's a big old one.
Yeah, mine has a silver cover. Yeah, but this is
$5.95.
No, it's very poetic. I love how he put it together, how he told the story, and it's almost like kind of songs, poems or songs.
He's one of those guys that drew some of the most beautiful women ever in comic books.
But see, to me, Jeff Jones, I never looked at him as, he did comic book work and it was nice, but I just, basically, the way I took it was, the only reason he did those is because he was hanging out with Von Bone and, you know, Jeff Jones, Michael Kaluta and Bernie Wrightson, and they were doing comics. I guess I'll do a few.
He started off as more of a Frazetta painter. Yeah. But, I mean, you know, everybody that was into Frazetta was into the comic books too, because that was the Frazetta that, you know, once you got past the Conan covers and the creepy covers and all that, you realize that the guy did a lot of strip work. So they were basically the fans of his. He was the most. He was probably the most illustrative of them all. You know, the other ones were more sequential. I mean, Barry Smith started out as a Kirby imitator. I was talking to a friend of mine before, and the other guys, you know, they were kind of like in the Frazetta, whatever,
Crinkle,
old school Crinkle, type of style or whatever. Yeah, Crinkle would have been the other one. He barely did comics. He was more of an illustrator too. So yeah, no, you know, that's just from years of.
Oh yeah.
Like that's part of it. Yeah, that's part dust, but that one got damaged a little bit through the years or whatever, but it took a licking, but it's still taking,
hey,
as
still
they
in
say.
Good shape, and to me a well-read book is a happy book.
And that's a happy book. That's been read.
And well deserved too. Jeff Jones didn't stop either. I was surprised. I was the early 2000s, I looked up Michael Kaluta on the internet. He had a really nice website.
He still does.
And I haven't been to it since then, but the front page he drew, it was a sketch of his studio.
It's still there.
And I love that. And at one point he has a pair of jeans hanging up on the
wall.
Yeah,
it's still there. The same
and
website.
Any section in there, you click on it and it takes you to a page and those pants. So why does he got pants hanging up there? And I clicked on it. It's a giant pair of jeans covered in those enamel buttons, you know, those enamel pins you can find.
Oh, yeah.
You know, my daughter was collecting those. Whenever you go to, like, amusement parks, like Disneyland or Disney World or something, you see people, I mean, young people, old people, people that work at the park wearing, like, a lanyard badge, a ball cap, a vest. At Walmart, Wendy's, any of the grocery stores, people work there, they have that stuff. Just covered in these enamel pins, which, to me, looks very uncomfortable. But my daughter, you know, when she was younger, had an enamel pin collection. And she saw those Michael Kaluta pants with about 7,000 of those things on it. And she had a heart attack. And but on his site, he had Jeff Jones' site. And I clicked on the link, and I was shocked. He was doing political cartoons.
Yeah, he did for
and
a little while.
Those are fantastic. They're the sketchy thing that you're always attributing. It's basically looked like he was using a single nib pen drawing them. And man, he just got, or she just got better and better. And they were strong cartoons. They were fantastic illustrations. And I was completely unaware of them.
There's supposed to be a movie, a documentary, but I haven't heard yet that it's been released. But there were, and I kind of missed out on it too. In the beginning, if you went on the site that showed you the trailer for it, it would take you to another site. It said, if you give a $25 donation, you'll get this limited edition print. I went to it, and at that point, it must have been a few years. The limited edition prints were up to like a 75 or 100, and it said not that many left. So I was like, oh, well, you know, I came in too late. But I was assuming that movie was out by now, but I guess it isn't. I have to look around and see if it is, but definitely worthwhile checking out. I mean, besides his artwork, his story is very interesting.
Yeah, it is. Well, some of that, I think that documentary, when he died, they were showing an interview with her now.
Yeah, it became a her.
And, but there were like three parts I was watching. It was kind of fascinating.
He became a her, but she was married to a woman. Go figure. Go figure that one. Like I said, I want to watch the movie and then find out what happens.
When I started liking Von Bode.
Oh, yeah.
There was a book called The Von Bode Index I picked up.
Oh, yeah. And
it was fascinating. It had pictures of him doing all those concerts at the colleges, you know, with the slides.
There's a clip of that on YouTube of him doing the cartoon
concert. I've never seen one.
It's on YouTube. He does the voices and everything, yeah.
But he got real popular doing those, and they had pictures of him when he was younger. Then they started showing him. There's one page. It was just photos of Von Bode from when he started out and when he grew the really long curly hair.
Now, he was an army guy before he did that. He was in the service.
Well, Fantagraphics even released some journals he did when he was in the army of all the cartoons and stuff.
Yeah.
And they had pictures of him and Jeff Jones together living in Woodstock, New York.
Oh yeah, gender bending.
And they were wearing high heels and mini skirts and mascara and They had a picture of Jeff Jones before he moved in with Von Bode. And, you know, he looked like we always knew him with the beard and everything.
Yeah, from the studio, yeah.
Yeah, and the next thing you know, he looks like actually a pretty attractive woman.
Yeah, it was weird. I've seen pictures of him before, and he was kind of frail looking. But when he was in the studio, the pictures, he's got like a beard on. He looks kind of like, oh, this is, you know, a dude or whatever.
Right.
But when they did the gender bender stuff, it was like, oh, my, you know.
Yeah, I thought that was odd. But no.
And he was married to Louise Jones at the time, too.
Yeah.
But what's funny is that she said something that's very interesting about him. She said that his artwork got a lot better when he started using photography. Because before that, he was just coming up with the stuff out of his head. And it was nice. The design was nice. But it was still kind of like, but as soon as he started using posing people and used photography, his work just kind of like took it to another level. So that's really interesting. And she said it on a, I saw it on a, it was on a blog. It was from some convention she was talking or whatever. Not that long ago. It was interesting. I didn't realize he was that much into, you know, reference and photography and stuff
like
that.
That's something I've met people that, were either some type of a commercial artist or their a relative was. And I'd always hear about they went on photo shoots with them. Really? Because I've never done any of that. Alex Toth had real strong feelings about that with Doug Wildey when they brought him on that.
Doug Wildey looks like somebody that used photo reference.
Oh, heavily. Well, was it? That Star Hunter? What was that? You know, that cartoon, Scott McCloud, the Sky Hunter.
God, I don't remember.
It was an animated cartoon.
Oh, you're talking about Johnny Quest?
No, before Johnny Quest. It was the one where they had the human lips on the animated figures.
Clutch Cargo?
No.
Space Angel?
Yeah, Space Angel.
That was Toth.
Yeah. Alex Toth was doing that, and they brought Doug Wildey in.
That's a disturbing cartoon, but anyway.
Well, I loved it when I was a kid when I saw it in Dallas. But, they said, what do you call it? You know, on a side note, The Incredibles, that Pixar movie?
Yeah.
If you buy the DVD, the second DVD is loaded with stuff, and one of them is Mr. Incredible and Frozone in an old 50s type cartoon with a bunny.
Oh, okay.
And their lips are real lips, you know, just like like Space Angel. And I watched it, and my daughter's like, "What is this?" And, oh, it's like these old 50s cartoons I used to watch in the 60s when I was a kid. Yeah, but what's funny is you can do a voiceover. And after you watch it, you can watch it with a voiceover, and it's the voices of Mr. Incredible and Frozone, which was who was the guy that played Samuel Jackson, I think. And they're talking about, you know, Samuel Jackson's what? Oh, well, why'd they make me white? You're not white. It's just how they did the coloring. They made me white. What's with these lips? You know, and he goes, it's a new technique they're trying to do. Those are real lips. That's so weird. You know, he's just going on. And what's with this bunny? They tested the kids like the bunny. You know, it was the funniest thing I'd ever saw. But anyway. But now Space Angel, Alex Toth was doing it. And they brought Doug Wiley in later on to assist. And Alex Toth, there was letters where he was writing. He really felt strongly that Doug Wiley couldn't do it because he relied so heavily on photo reference. And Alex Toth said that just kind of cripples you. Alex Toth didn't do it. Well,
no.
It worked for him, but a lot of times if you don't use some type of reference, everything looks flat and kind of just character side by side. Alex Toth seemed to be able to visualize everything and put it together, but
Alex Toth was more of a cartoonist, and Doug Wiley was more of an illustrator.
Yeah, and then it was kind of funny because on Johnny Quest, that was Doug Wiley's thing, and they brought Alex Toth in to help.
Yeah. They were the West Coast guys.
Later, I guess Alex Toth did feel that Doug Wiley could do the job. Because it's kind of odd that, you know, Jeff Jones improved when he started using photo reference.
Yeah, because he had the design. You can see by this Flash Gordon that the design in the panels is there. It's just the figures kind of look a little, they don't look solid enough. But as soon as he started using photo reference, people started like looking more, you know, like people. And his artwork even got better in the paintings too. You know, as the paintings went on, the first ones were kind of like almost like cartoony Frazetta type things. But as they went on, the people had more weight to them and they had more texture and stuff like that. And that was from using, I don't know how extensively he did, but I think he did a good amount of it, and that's how it got better.
Well, Steve Root uses a heavy amount of photo referencing when he does it.
A lot of the comic books artists now do. I mean, I was talking to Dez, our friend, about it, and he was like, how can you tell the difference between when they're using photo reference and when it's they're not? I go, well, you can just tell by, sometimes you can tell by the shadows. You can tell by the folds in the clothing, you know, how you know, like it, or even better, when you go into a building and you see this incredibly detailed, like, office building or whatever, you're not gonna come up with that out of your head. That's a photo reference, especially the outside of buildings when they look exactly like the Empire State Building or the Eiffel Tower, Dakota Building. That's photo reference, you know, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with it.
Well, the difference is, I guess, with Steve Rude, he uses photo reference, but it's all drawing, and some of that stuff is just drawn right out of his head, especially when he does that wild stuff in Nexus. But I guess there's just a fine line between heavily using photo reference and never veering away from it, and using photo reference for a grounding and then just going off from there.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, one of the books I was going to talk about that's here somewhere.
It's the very bottom.
That's at the very bottom is the Dark Shadows comic strip book by Ken Bald. Ken Bald is a Golden Age artist, and he's probably, might be the last one. Well, no, Nick Carty's still around, but he's one of the few still around. And he did this Dark Shadows book back, I guess, in the early 70s when it was a big deal. And this guy is a fantastic artist. You can tell when he uses photo reference, and you can tell when he doesn't, because there's stock people that you draw, you know, that you have an idea what they're going to look like. And then when you see Barnabas Collins, you know, that's not coming out of anybody's brain. That's like taken from an actual picture. So it's kind of that's one way you can tell. You can tell Kirby didn't use photo reference, okay? Because he was stock people or whatever. But in that book, you look at some characters and they look exactly like the people in the show, and other characters just look kind of like a nice looking woman or whatever. You can tell. But that's a really nice book. The repro is kind of small, but Ken Bald was an amazing artist. He also did, I found him online too, some Sunday strips, Dr. Kildare from like the 60s or whatever. Beautiful art in the same kind of like Stan Drake kind of style or whatever, you know. It looks like art studio, you know, not Neil Adams, but in that, you know, in that kind of style or whatever. So It's really great stuff. Oh, there you go. There you'll be getting to them pretty soon.
Oh, it was a comic strip in the newspaper?
Yeah, it was in the it was a newspaper comic strip with Dark Shadows. Yeah, early 70s.
First, I thought it was a comic book, and then I'm looking at it. This is a strip.
There was a comic book also, but not as nice. Not as nice as that.
This is nice work. How long did this run?
Looks like about a year or two, maybe. Maybe not that long. I'm wondering if I'm not sure exactly the dates. It might have come out either towards the end of the strip. So, I mean, the soap opera, or maybe when the two movies came out, and the two movies that just got re-released on Warner Archives too, The House of Dark Shadows. And
I didn't know they did movies.
Yeah, they did House of Dark Shadows and Night of Dark Shadows. Yeah, I got them somewhere. I'll find them for you. The first one's real good. The second one's not as good, but the first one's got the Barnabas Collins story told in, you know, like theatrically or whatever, and it's a little more violent than the show ever was. And the second one doesn't have Barnabas Collins because Fred decided he didn't want to play him anymore, so they got everybody else except for him to play Barnabas Collins. Yeah, there were two movies, and they actually do play on Turner Classic Movies occasionally, you know. But yeah, I'll find them for you, man. They're not bad. The first one's not bad at all.
For those of you too young to remember, Dark Shadows was a soap opera about a vampire.
Well, it didn't start out that way. It started out as a gothic soap opera, and it was going nowhere. And apparently, like, the producer, Dan Curtis, who did a lot of TV work, was sitting at the dining room table and, you know, was talking to his daughter, and his daughters were talking about vampire movies or something along those lines. And he was like, hey, maybe I'll stick a vampire in my soap opera and see what happens. And, yeah, that was a missing ingredient.
Yeah, and he had that cane.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the show on the cover.
And he was like an older guy. And he became like a sex symbol too, Jonathan Frid, you know?
Yeah. Well,
he was kind of like in his 40s back then, but the chicks dug him.
Because that was in like 1966 is the first time I saw it.
And through about 71 it went on through.
And I just remember the commercials always fascinated me. He always showed that house
and that music
with the tower.
Too.
And it had the lightning bolt, you know, and it just seemed, I was always in it. I was like four or five. But every time I'd watch, my mom would watch it a little bit, but every time it'd come on, I'd see it. I was kind of interested, and it was just talking. You know, it was a soap opera.
Slow moving.
And I would lose interest, but
maybe once a week you'd get a vampire or a werewolf or something.
Yeah, there was a werewolf called Quentin, which
I did really like.
Yeah,
with the munchausen.
Yeah. And, well, it was the 60s.
David Selby. Well, no, I mean, back in the olden days, I guess, some of them were set in the olden days. They had those long sideburns. Or
oh, really? Okay.
Some of them were set in the olden days, and then they went back to the modern age. I'm not sure if Quentin was, like, from the olden days or the new guy. I'm not 100% sure.
Oh, I didn't know that. I just remember one of my best friends and his sister were huge Dark Shadows fans, and me and my friends in the neighborhood would always watch Gilligan's Island. And it'd be over. That was always a fight. My mom would make us.
Wait a minute. Now you mentioned Gilligan's Island. Marianne or Tina or Ginger?
It'd have to be Marianne.
Yeah, okay, you know. I agree. Anyway.
I liked them both. But, you know, as a kid, the one I always liked was when Marianne fell over and woke up, thought she was Ginger. And if she was dressing like Ginger did, gosh, she's better looking than Ginger is. But,
yeah.
If
you want to get freaky, maybe Mrs. Howell. Nah.
You know, I always liked her. What?
Natalie Schaefer.
I was watching something about her on, I was one of those behind the music type shows or something.
Natalie Schaefer? Really? Mrs. Howell?
Well, what was funny was she was a lot older than Mr. Howell was.
She was? I didn't know
the
that.
Actress herself.
Jim Backus, Mr. McCoo.
It was always, yeah. He was great. But she always, she hit her age completely. Kind of find out she's a lot older than anybody thought.
Huh.
But, you know, she was an old actress, and the thing that would really irritate her is Jim Backus ad-libbed all of his lines.
I didn't know that.
And he completely ad-libbed, and it was driving her insane because she was never trained to do that. And it got to be kind of one-upmanship because she was she was trying to outdo him all the time in a fun way. It wasn't hate or anything. But I thought that was neat. And then they were showing it in the afternoon sometimes. And there was one period where I started watching them. I haven't seen these since I was a kid. And she's really funny.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I always liked her. But when I got older, I thought, isn't she just wonderful? Just some of the things she said. And There was one episode where I can't remember why, but they were trying to figure out how Marianne walked. And the skipper, Gilligan, and the professor are all arguing about it, and they're all trying to walk like Marianne, and then or walk like women. I can't remember exactly what the thing was, but Mrs. Howell busts in and goes, she just called out something about, oh, it's the debutante ball, and I missed it, or something. But it's just how she said it was just hilarious.
Yeah, and that old rich lady kind of style.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
Whatever.
But no,
yeah, that was great. That was
you know, Marianne lived around here.
Yeah, I know. I know. And you know what's, you know, another thing too? Remember, like, in the first season, they had the theme song. In the second season, they had to add.
Yeah.
And Professor and Marianne.
Yeah, before it was, and the rest of, oh, what's
yeah,
that
the
about?
Rest. And then it was like, oh, okay, wait a minute. We got to put them in next year because they're, you know, got to give them some props or whatever.
Yeah, that one I always thought was, yeah, because it was the black and white episode.
Yeah, when, yeah. Was there any color ones?
Oh, yeah. Most of them were color.
Oh, God. That's been so long since I watched it then.
Oh,
I just remember the black and white.
I think the first season was black and white, and then after that it was color. Most of the shows we ever saw were color. The black and white ones, when they did show them, was like, ooh, that's weird.
Years ago, like I'm talking about like another one, like 15, 16 years ago, I was at an autograph show in South Florida, and I saw Russell Johnson there. He was still... He might still be alive. I'm not sure, but
the
he still looked good. The professor, he still looked good like 15 years ago. He was because he was also in what was the movie? I don't know if it was Forbidden Planet or one of those. But he's also in a couple of classic sci-fi movies from the 50s. So yeah, he still looked good, man. You know, and of course there were Gilligan's Island comic books probably put out by Dell sometime in the 60s.
And they had that really bad animated cartoon in the mid 70s.
I never saw that.
Filmation did it.
Yeah, well.
But no, back to Dark Shadows, that's, I never enjoyed watching it, but my friend and his sister worshipped it. It was a popular show for a lot of people.
Yeah, I liked it. You know, I liked it, but it was slow moving. You'd be sitting there waiting for like a week to see like a vampire or, you know, or a werewolf or whatever. And then when they'd come out, you'd be like, oh, okay, that was really cool, you know, but then, you know. Then you went through another week of nothing, so I was like, Russell Johnson is still alive, man. That's amazing. He was born in 24, so he's got to be like 80-something or whatever. Oh, my God. That is freaking amazing. Oh, my God. Yeah, I mean, these were like, you know, these are the classic shows or whatever from the time. But, yeah, getting back to Ken Ball, he's still around, man. I don't know if he's painting or drawing anymore, but he's really like an unsung hero. He was doing stuff in the 40s. I can't remember exactly what book he drew, but he was kind of like one of the guys that did that work for all the comic book companies. So he's great.
Honestly, I've never heard of him. I like his work, and they have pictures of him and his wife in the front, and from 1994, he really held up really well.
He's still around now. He still looks good. He's got to be close to 90.
Yeah, but I mean, he looks good. He looks like he's full of life. It looks like they have a good life.
I don't know if he draws anymore. I mean, I you know, I would think that he would or whatever.
If he's still alive, he's drawing.
Yeah, probably. You know, I don't think Nick Carty's taking commissions anymore. I saw that he was in so I'm wondering if he's just gotten to the point now where he's just tired of it or whatever.
Well, he probably draws, just not for the...
Not for... Okay. Russell Johnson was in This Island Earth. That's the one he was in. I couldn't remember exactly which one. That's the one with the big foreheads on the dudes.
Yeah, which is awesome.
With Faith Domerg and, you know, all those other cool guys or whatever. So, all right. Hey, man, we're getting, like, close to the end. You want to do one more review there? Go for it.
On
go
me?
For it. Yeah, you. You're the man.
Yeah, I've always wanted to be the man.
Now you are.
Make it happen. One book that I really liked, and I was actually kind of surprised they did it, was 47 Running.
That was the one by Stan?
Stan Sakai, okay. And also Mike Richardson, the Dark Horse publisher. And I've always heard of the story of 47 Running, and there's always the book there starts out, to know 47 Ronin is to know Japan. And I've always heard references to it. Those Japanese puppet shows, I don't know what they call them, but one of the most popular ones is 47 Ronin. And I've heard the title, I was familiar with it, but I never knew anything about it whatsoever. And I started reading about Stan Sakai, who does Usagi Yojimbo, always, you know, referenced it and researched it and always wanted to do it someday. And but, you know, he's been busy with his own work and never got to do it or got around to it. Well, he was kind of surprised to find out Mike Richardson has been researching it ever since he's been doing, you know, publishing comics. And he's always wanted to. And I guess he's worked with some other people to do it and things fell through. And he finally approached Stan Sakai to do it. And so they both did it together. It's a 5-issue series. They stopped doing Usagi Jimbo till it's finished. And again, I'm a huge Stan Sakai fan, so I was going to buy it no matter what. And the editorial consultant was Kazuo Koiki, which is the writer of Lone Wolf and Cub. Again,
yeah,
one of my favorites.
Yeah, that's right. I thought that name was familiar.
Yeah, he's the guy that wrote Lone Wolf and Cub and all that other work. But he was the editorial consultant. Now, I guess him and Mike Richardson are friends, so he's checked it out. It's fantastic. I absolutely love it. I like how Stan Sakai drew it. You know, it's not the funny animals that he does in Usagi
Jimbo. It looks like his work, though.
It certainly looks like his work, and
he didn't like change his style or anything for it. It's
no.
Got the same feel to it.
Well, he's the type of artist. Everything he draws, you know, looks one way. I've always been fascinated with artists like Mobius and stuff that can work with different styles. Sometimes I see artists that talk about they have several different styles, but some styles don't work very well. Mobius, everything he did worked really well. But Stan Sakai is the type of artist, he's got a style and he stays with it, and I actually prefer it that way.
Cool.
And they said try to make it look as much like a Japanese woodcut as you can, and I guess the colorist did the same thing. It's strong work. I've read on the internet, most people are like me, they really liked it. They're Stan Sakai fans. So I was just reading one guy write about it, and he was upset. I guess he felt he would have rather had an artist that drew like Lone Wolf and Cub or something. And he said, you know, Stan Sakai is a funny animal artist and it doesn't work. I don't agree with him, but...
Who said that?
I don't know. Just some guy on the internet.
Oh, okay.
Well, he's got a valid point. I understand what he says, but, you know, comic book, you can draw it any way you want.
Sure.
So,
sure.
And I really like how this one looks, and the story is strong. It gets into the whole, it's basically he's dealing with a corrupt official, and it looks like it's destroying this one man's life. And that's as far as it's gone, but I can't recommend this enough. I bought an issue, and I bought a second issue to send to my nephew, who's heavily into this type of stuff.
Cool.
So.
But Dark Horse, right?
Yeah, it's Dark Horse.
Nice. All right, man. Well, you know, it's that time. The clock on the wall says.
Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah, definitely. So we'll be back. And what was it that Dallas always says?
Read more comics.